queer life in Montreal was wild.
Montreal in the 90s was a great time, but it had a dark side.
It was not a safe city for gay people back then.
But what else was behind a series of deaths in the city?
Somebody's killing gay men. We want to know why.
I'm Francis Plourde, and this is The Village, The Montreal Murders. Get early access to episodes at cbc.ca/listen or by subscribing to the CBC True Crime Premium channel on Apple Podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud. D.C. is in the midst of confirmation hearings for Biden's new cabinet. Some of the picks, though, have generated a lot of controversy. In today's episode, we're going to do a deep dive into just one of those picks. That name is Neera Tanden. She might not be a household name, especially here in Canada, but she is a useful lens to look at a lot of different layers of D.C. culture and also the future of the Democratic Party. I'm speaking with Caitlin Burns, a freelance journalist and contributing writer to Vox and Medium, and Sabrina Siddiqui with The Wall Street Journal. You're listening to Party in the USA. Let's get started. Caitlin, Sabrina, welcome to the show. Sabrina, of course, welcome back to the show. So glad to have both of you on today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Now, before we get into our topic of the day, we got to talk about the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, because we got to get some reactions.
But who knows? Who knows? I may even decide to beat them for a third time, okay?
He's back, first of all. Caitlin, what did you make of Trump's appearance?
My takeaway from his speech was really the first time that he's repeated a bunch of anti-trans talking points in an actual speech or stump speech format. Previously, you know, his administration took a lot of anti-trans action specifically, but he kind of stayed out of the messaging side of it. Mm-hmm. So I think that was the thing that really jumped out to me as like a big departure from what we've seen and heard from him previously.
Sabrina, what about you? What jumped out at you?
Well, I think it's just remarkable how much the Republican Party has tied its fate to a singular figure. And it was sort of like, you know, a homecoming. And, you know, you saw him really traffic in conspiracy theories once again around the outcome of the election, about the coronavirus pandemic, and, you know, naming his enemies, specifically the Republicans who voted to impeach him in the House and then convict him in the Senate for his role in inciting the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. And I think just demonstrating that he really continues to have a great deal of power over the GOP. And so as they kind of litigate this post-Trump future, it's just not clear that a future exists without Donald Trump, because the party has already dug in its heels. And I just don't think that they can put back into the can what has already been unleashed in terms of the influence that he has had, not just on the party, but also more importantly, I think, on the Republican electorate.
I have to say that I honestly kind of found it a little bit disorienting, mostly because, you know, he's been not in the headlines as much, at least since the inauguration, but a little before that, because he was taken off Twitter. And so it felt disorienting to be subtly thrust back into that world, subtly thrust back into the world where a bunch of people are chanting, "You won, you won, you won," at Donald Trump. What did you make of the tone of the event, Caitlin?
And the thing I keep coming back to is I think the conservative movement at the moment really is sort of out of ideas, and they're sort of stuck in this cult of personality. And I think we saw that play out with CPAC this weekend. I wrote a couple of weeks ago for The New Republic about how there really isn't much going on policy-wise within the GOP. And one thing I noted yesterday in the discussion about CPAC is people saying that, oh, Trump is going to get back to policy, but he really didn't. He just kind of did his usual speech about, you know, the election being rigged and targeting his political enemies. And he, I have noted earlier, he added this anti-trans element. So I really am sort of struck by the lack of ideas going on the right side of the aisle right now.
What about you, Sabrina? What was the general tone of the event?
Well, it really was, you know, I think a reflection of where the Republican Party stands and really, once again, ready to embrace Trump. And if you're not Donald Trump, then you better have fashioned yourself in his image. Again, really a party that is not really about substance. It's entirely, as Caitlin put out, about a cult of personality, right? And so, you know, it's, I think that Republicans in Washington, there's a faction of them, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who, despite enabling Trump, want to now turn a page and suggest that the QAnon is, you know, the QAnon contingent of the party and the real hardcore Trump base is just is on the fringes. But what Trump actually did is he took what was on the fringes and he injected it into the mainstream. So I think it's just phenomenal to see that after even the insurrection where people thought maybe this is the moment where Republicans break from Trump, CPAC suggests that that's anything but the case.
Mm. It's certainly something that I and many others are going to be continuing to watch, because at a certain point, the Republican Party would have to put something on the table, some kind of idea, some kind of policy statement that says this is what the party is about. At least CPAC kind of showed that they're not ready to do that yet. But we're going to shift gears on this, because we are here to talk about Neera Tanden. And Sabrina, I'm going to start with you. Can you tell us who she is and why she's been such a magnet of controversy?
The why she's been a magnet of controversy is ironic, but let me first start with who she is. Neera Tanden is a longtime Democratic political consultant. She has served in prior administrations. Most recently, she was at the helm of the Center for American Progress, also known as CAP, which has been one of the kind of power centers as far as progressive think tanks are concerned, although I would say that they somewhat broke with the progressive movement, in part because Neera Tanden was a vocal supporter of Hillary Clinton's and critic of Bernie Sanders in the 2016 election. Now, she has had a past of tweeting whatever she thinks. And so she has written tweets about Democrats and Republicans alike that, you know, are pretty sharp in tone.
I deeply regret my comments.
Understand that, but when you said them, did you mean them? I understand you've taken them back, but did you mean them?
I'd say the discourse over the last 4 years on all sides has been incredibly polarizing.
I'm asking about yours. Did you mean?
So that is something that now has imperiled her nomination to serve at the helm of the Office of Management and Budget. And, you know, she would make history as the first Indian American woman, if confirmed, in that role. But I think, like, the fact that Republicans care about tweets is really striking, because if I'm not wrong, for the last 4 years, there was a president who largely governed through Twitter and never held back.
Yeah, I love a world where we now care about tweets. I have to say that, so this story is, she is Biden's choice to run the Office of Management and Budget. But Caitlin, as she emerged as Biden's pick, a lot of other red flags associated with her as a candidate kind of came out. Can you give us some of the highlights?
Yeah, I think for me, one of the most under talked about aspects of Neera's legacy is the fact that she closed down Think Progress, which was a very progressive news and commentary site that was owned and run by the Center for American Progress. And, you know, CAP and Think Progress had had some union fights over the years, and I think they were locked in a union dispute when the decision to close down came through. But we're living in a world now where there's, you know, 1,000 right-wing, you know, extreme right-wing news outlets that are purveying not only the right wing like political view, but presenting their own version of the facts in the news. And just me personally as a journalist who does lean to the left, I think it's important for the political left to have an answer for that. And to me, I think Progress, I think, did a pretty good job of doing that. So it was concerning to me that she would close it down. Now, she did say that there were financial reasons behind that closure, but, you know, many of the former employees of Think Progress felt it was union motivated, which is also sort of a red mark against Neera's candidacy in my mind, especially if she's going to management and budget. And, you know, I think it's a really difficult line to walk with Neera, right? Because, like, I see the tweets, and there were tweets that really bothered me. She has this really bombastic presence on Twitter. But then I think, like, okay, in the Trump era, we had Rick Grenell, who, you know, his claim to fame before becoming an ambassador was that he was a Twitter troll. And then he ended up being one of the most powerful acting members of Trump's administration. So, like, it makes me step back and pause and thinking, am I using a double standard here?
You know, the tweets are a part of the controversy, but they're not the only part. There are reports that she physically assaulted an employee before. She reportedly outed a sexual harassment victim. In addition to, you know, the maybe busting a union of journalists. Caitlin, Democrats are supposed to be this party that respects workers' rights, that honors women's rights, that fights for social programs, government ethics. Why are they trying so hard to rescue Neera Tanden's nomination?
Well, I think she was, you know, a very... Oh, God, I hate this term. I think she was a very outspoken foot soldier during the campaign for them, quite honestly. But... you know, I think you make great points. She also made repeated arguments against Medicare for All when she was opposing Bernie Sanders' primary candidacy. So, I don't know. I think there are reasons that more left-leaning or progressive Democrats should perhaps be looking at her nomination with a side eye. But, you know, Democrats don't want to see her go away. She is a very experienced administrator. Like Sabrina said, she served in previous administrations. She has a lot of experience. I think she was also one of the more powerful people in progressive circles in Washington, just due to her leadership at CAP.
You know, I will say, because I think there's a lot of important points that Caitlin has raised, and there is a lot of controversy that goes beyond the tweets, right? I mean, obviously, I was being flippant in part because it's more so it's ironic for Republicans to say that they're worried about tweets, and that is, of course, why her nomination is in trouble on Capitol Hill, where Democrats, you know, they can approve her nomination with a simple majority vote, but, you know, they've lost one vote in Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, who is a more moderate Democrat, and I think he's also citing the tweets because he thinks she would be too polarizing. But, you know, there is, the allegation that she outed a sexual harassment victim, that she physically assaulted an employee. You know, there are also allegations that she busted a union of journalists. You know, under her stewardship, CAP, Center for American Progress, took a lot of corporate cash, money from foreign governments. So, you know, I think that, like, there are, of course, issues that go well beyond just what she has tweeted in the past. She's a very combative personality, but I think for Joe Biden, of course, it's embarrassing for any nominee to go down.
So plan B if Neera Tanden doesn't work out, and could you give us a sense of what that looks like?
Well, the White House's focus, the president's focus, is on working toward the confirmation of Neera Tanden to lead, to be the OMB director. That is our focus.
You know, just as a fun Canadian aside, put on my Canada hat for a minute. In Canada, our cabinet is chosen by the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister goes to choose some members of his own party, and that's it. And then they're sworn in. You know, in the U.S., you have this kind of tense atmosphere where the Senate has to approve most, but not all, of the candidates that any president wants to appoint. In this case, Joe Biden has a bunch of names that he's putting forward. Caitlin, is it often that the president's chosen cabinet members get rejected in these contexts?
Well, I think we have to remember we're coming from an administration where, a significant part of the cabinet had the acting label simply because they weren't able to get confirmed in the Senate. Or in some cases, I think they didn't even try to confirm people in the Senate for various reasons. So I don't know. Is there a new normal? It seems like a lot of people want a reset back to sort of the old rules of trying to get everybody approved, but my question would be, didn't Donald Trump turn that on its head by sort of abusing the acting label for so many of his key cabinet positions?
Well, so can I just ask, like, okay, if there's been so many people who have been in an acting role over the last few years, and that has kind of served to circumvent the process of getting a Senate confirmation and having to have all these fights out, what is the point of getting a Senate confirmation? Like, is it helpful to go through this process, Caitlin?
I don't know how to answer that question, honestly. I think Trump proved that the Senate confirmation process, at least for cabinet members, doesn't really matter. But this is something that is in our Constitution, right? You know, Trump really wasn't following the law when he was exploiting the sort of acting label. And one of Biden's big campaign promises was that he wanted to, you know, bring things back to normal. He wanted to introduce the process again in Washington. So, you know, all of his nominees are going to go or attempt to go through the confirmation process in the Senate. I think that's the big takeaway, is that Biden is trying to go back to the Constitution, go back to tradition in doing things the right way. And I think it's smart on his part because, especially with the accusations of, you know, potential election fraud, which have proven repeatedly to be false and without basis. But following the rules to a T can kind of help the perception of Biden's legitimacy.
We're going to take a quick break there. And when we come back, more about Neera Tanden's nomination and what it means for the future of the Democrats.
I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history, not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we are back, and we're speaking with journalists Caitlin Burns and Sabrina Siddiqui. And Sabrina, Tanden is getting all this criticism from both sides of the aisle. It's not just the Republicans who are pointing out the tweets. There's also, you know, those Democrats who are doing the same. Can we just, like, ground ourselves in the tweets themselves? How bad were these tweets?
So I think it depends, right? You know, some of these are inflammatory, perhaps. It's hard because it's almost impossible to not look at things in the context of Trump. It's not just that she's tweeted criticism of Republicans. You know, I mean, there are people with whom she's clashed just on Twitter, whether it's journalists or just people involved in politics. And I think it's just, you know, it's someone who's very combative and who has probably tweeted stuff that, if you're just sitting there and you don't have a role in government, not saying it's great to be, you know, engaged in Twitter fights and saying incendiary things, but there's less implications to doing so. But if you are someone who has worked in administrations and wants to continue and work in a future administration, then yeah, I think it's a little more complicated. Now, some of the stuff I think about Republicans, okay, she called Ted Cruz a vampire and likened him to Voldemort, right? A lot of people might just kind of dismiss that and laugh. She's referred to Mitch McConnell by the hashtag Moscow Mitch. You know, outside of just the rank and file back and forth with Republicans, there has been an inclination on her part to go after critics who include progressives who are disagreeing on issues of policy, or perhaps just with the Democratic establishment in Washington. And there, and so there, I think, is where she's been very combative in a way that sort of calls into question whether or not this is someone who is best positioned, right, to be at the helm of a major cabinet agency in Washington.
Now, Caitlin, a lot of Democrats are pointing out that it is a little absurd how this nomination is being derailed into just like a topic, a discussion of online etiquette. You mentioned a name earlier, Richard Grenell. How are Republicans able to do this, given the history with Richard Grenell? And also, can you give us a bit more of that history? Because I think he was the ambassador to Germany, right?
Yeah. He was the ambassador to Germany. He had quite a few quote-unquote acting cabinet roles, I think, before the Trump administration ended, or before the term ended. But so Richard Grenell is... how do I describe Richard Grenell? He is an openly gay man, but he's very much from a Trumpian mold of conservatism. You know, he constantly attacks trans people. He has been accused of racism in the past. He just has one of those bombastic presences on Twitter. And when I was writing about the comparison between Grenell and Tandon, I did go back and read a bunch of the articles from when he was first nominated to become ambassador to Germany. And the most common qualification given or like reasons to know who Richard Grenell is that he was a Twitter troll. That he would dive into any issue and take the most offensive, loud stance that he could in an effort to get attention. So I would say that is who Richard Grenell is. I'm more familiar with him from his anti-trans tweets, because I would engage with those, because that is kind of like my beat. I'm a trans person myself. So those sort of rose to my attention earliest on. But I know that it wasn't just trans issues that he was kind of trolling about. And there's a second part to your question I think I haven't answered yet, but I don't remember what the question was.
I mean, the question broadly was like, how are Republicans able to, you know, focus so much on online etiquette given this history of a candidate like this?
Well, I think they have different rules for everybody. They have their own set of rules that apply to Democrats and not them. And that's just the way it is. And they're allowed to get away with it because they, you know, don't have any group consciousness or conscious of their actions, and they don't really need to answer for any sort of hypocrisy in the press, because there's such a large right-wing misinformation system that's already out there. So they don't feel any responsibility to be consistent in these types of views at all. And we see this play out not just in this argument, but in quite a few others as we go along. You know, it's different rules for them that they are like really strict about upholding in their opponents.
And this is an important point because, you know, you mentioned Rick Grenell, and there are a lot of people in the Trump administration who also had tweeted all kinds of incendiary things, or if not tweeted, said them in public. You know, Ryan Zinke, one of the Trump cabinet officials, called Hillary Clinton the Antichrist. Dana Milbank at the Washington Post has a good column that I pulled up where he's going through some of these examples. Jeff Sessions, who was the first attorney general under Trump, he said that the NAACP was a quote-unquote pinko organization that hates white people. You know, Mike Pompeo, who, you know, is the Secretary of State under Trump, he liked a tweet calling former his Secretary of State John Kerry a traitor and Vietnam's worst export. I mean, you know, so it's just really difficult for Republicans to, you know, suggest that what Neera Tandon has tweeted is so uniquely offensive. I think, you know, for Democrats, the challenge is just that they said they would do things differently, right? Biden had this whole theme to his campaign around decency, and we're going to, you know, bring back decorum and do things a different way. And so I think that sort of, if, because he has created a higher standard for his presidency, I think as far as Democrats are concerned, then they're kind of bound to that in some ways. But of course, I mean, if you think everything that I was just listing off coming from a variety of Trump cabinet officials, I just don't think anyone can really buy into Republicans suggesting that this is that the tweets are reason alone to sink her nomination. And I also think there's an interesting contrast just with experience too, right? No one is arguing that Neera Tanden doesn't have the experience for the job. They're just questioning whether or not this is the right person for the job, given just all of the controversies that are, have now ensnared her nomination. But I also just think if you look at the Trump administration, one of the big criticisms was that none of his cabinet nominees had the relevant, almost none of his cabinet nominees had the relevant experience for the job. And Caitlin pointed out very, I think, smartly that as time went on, Trump just put acting cabinet secretaries in place. He didn't even go through the Senate confirmation process.
Sabrina, Neera Tanden would be the first woman of color and first Asian American to lead the Office of Management and Budget. And Democrats have pointed out that the degree of scrutiny that she's facing is so great, partly because she's a woman of color. Is that a fair assessment here?
Well, I think, of course, we have seen throughout history that women, as well as people of color, as well as women of color, are held to a different standard just across the board. And so that is a long-running frustration that I think for many people is manifesting itself through Neera Tanden's nomination. And, you know, I think, you know, there's just this sense that, you know, how dare this woman have said all these things, right? When we have seen, again, a lot of the people in the Trump administration constantly push the boundaries with respect to what they said about their political opponents. And the president himself did so from the Oval Office, right? So, you know, if you think about, I mean, really it was every other day that the news was driven by Donald Trump saying something incendiary or tweeting something derogatory about women, about people of color, about Muslims, about immigrants, about LGBTQ people. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on and on. So I think, you know, that of course raises questions about why Neera Tanden specifically is being held under this microscope. But, I think it also gets back to the experience question too, right? Even if you put aside some of the more controversial elements of her nomination, there's just a different kind of vetting that seems to be happening for some of the Biden cabinet officials or nominees, I should say, because they're not confirmed yet, compared with those under Trump. I mean, you know, you have, it's not that people cannot raise issues or questions about nominees, and this process exists for a reason. But I think because of just the complete breakdown of norms that we saw under Trump, now you're just looking at a fundamentally different landscape where people are going to obviously raise the question, well, how come this was not an issue under Trump? Why is it an issue now? And it just so happens that Biden has put forward this historically diverse cabinet. So there is also, of course, going to be, I think, a lot of questions about whether or not some of his nominees who are not just women of color, but people of color are being held to a different standard.
You know, Caitlin, I have to say that this appears to be at least a part of the point, right? Like part of the point that, you know, you're not just rebuilding norms, but you're rebuilding the norms with a lot of firsts, you know? You've written about Dr. Rachel Levine in Vox, and if she's confirmed by the Senate, she would become the highest ranking openly transgender government official in U.S. history. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this is sort of a perfect storm of transphobic bigotry, I think, at the moment. So Dr. Rachel Levine is the nominee to be the Assistant Secretary of Health. She has impeccable qualifications. She's been the Surgeon General of the state of Pennsylvania and has run the health department in Pennsylvania, you know, for years. She's an openly trans woman with a laundry list of accomplishments. But we're in this cultural moment where trans issues have sort of taken on this culture. It's become a crux of the culture war, I guess you could say. And certainly I would say that the Republican Party of today is obsessed with trans issues. It's just a nonstop barrage through their media apparatus and on Twitter and other social media platforms. But, you know, you had her a first nomination hearing on the same day that the House passed the Equality Act, which would, add LGBT people to the nation's civil rights laws. So it's like a perfect storm, right? It's this cultural moment where conservatives are freaking out about this tiny gender minority. You have Democrats in the House pushing historic legislation to protect that minority. And then you also have Rachel Levine, who would be the first Senate-confirmed openly trans government official in U.S. history. And I think it all just sort of has added up to a not great situation for both Rachel and trans people around the country. Senator Rand Paul had just an inaccurate and offensive line of questions during her first hearing, where, you know, he asked her about 3-year-olds getting, you know, gender reassignment surgery, which is just not a thing that happens at all, ever.
Senator, transgender medicine is a very complex and nuanced field. And if confirmed to the position of Assistant Secretary of Health, I would certainly be pleased to come to your office and talk with you and your staff about the standards of care and the complexity of this field.
Not a lot of Americans know any trans people, so they don't know these things. So they, of course, it's believable to somebody who's never met a trans person that a 3-year-old might be getting some gender reassignment surgery. So Rand Paul takes this and he runs with it.
Let it go into the record that the witness refused to answer the question.
And attacks illegitimately, you know, a perfectly qualified Senate nominee.
And I should say that, like, that Rand Paul line of questioning, the minute this sort of started emerging, it was like, oh, this is, you know, appears to be state-sanctioned transphobia. Like, it was, like, very public in the most, you know, in a highly respected forum where you're supposed to talk about the credentials of the person in front of you. You were getting these transphobic questions. And it was shocking for a lot of people to see, but I guess he wasn't, it was like shocking, but he wasn't surprising. You know what I mean?
No, I wasn't surprised at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you mentioned the House passing the Equality Act on Thursday. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because it's anticipated that it's going to face a struggle in the Senate.
Yeah, I don't think they'll get to 60 votes in the Senate on the Equality Act. And if they do, I don't think it'll be a good bill for trans people. I just don't see 10 Republicans coming out in this political moment in support of trans rights specifically. I think if it was just, you know, lesbian, gay, and bisexual rights, that may be a different story. The thing that I worry about is that they're going to split off trans rights from the rest of the bill in order to get those 10 votes. And this would just be a replay of what we saw in 2007 with ENDA, which was the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And that nearly split the LGBT movement in two back then. It was extremely ugly. You had Democratic members of the House, Barney Frank, calling for excluding trans people from the bill. You know, Barney Frank, was talking about, you know, trans women's penises and women's showers. And it turned into a very ugly affair. And eventually they just ended up killing the legislation altogether rather than risk splitting apart the movement. And, you know, as a trans person, I'm very concerned about a replay. I think that the movement itself will do a better job standing together. But I have a hard time imagining 10 Republicans or even Joe Manchin supporting a trans-inclusive Equality Act in the Senate.
Now, let's go back to talking about Neera Tanden real quick, because it's about our time to wrap up soon. And I want to ask about this, Sabrina. Tanden is kind of the embodiment of the Democrats' internal struggle between progressives and moderates. You know, on the one hand, she was a Clinton advisor, and a lot of her rageful tweets were directed against Bernie Sanders and the progressive wing of the party. On the other, she is a woman of color who the party is trying to pass and that this administration is trying to pass into a pretty important role. What does her nomination mean about where progressives fit into the Biden government and like the direction of the Democratic Party here?
With Biden's cabinet nominations more broadly, I think this is interesting because on the one hand, he did have all of these historic firsts with respect to, people of color, with respect to having so many women. We've gone through the list. And at the same time, that doesn't necessarily mean that the cabinet is progressive, right? So, you know, there's for Democrats, they pride themselves in having a party that they say is more reflective of the country's diversity. That was a big pledge that Biden had also made in terms of what his cabinet would look like. But that should not necessarily be conflated with progressive policy. And so you had a lot of pushback from progressives like Bernie Sanders, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, just other Elizabeth Warren, other leaders in the progressive wing in Washington, on, you know, a sense that there weren't many progressive voices when it came to actual policy. There are some, to be sure, but you know, I think there were a lot more, I think, nominees and have been a lot more nominees, including Neera Tanden, who are more reflective of that Biden center-left Democratic politics. And so, you know, I think with Neera especially, I mean, she, despite being at the helm of CAP, what was once sort of like the kind of foremost liberal think tank in Washington, is very much a center-left she's not a politician. She's very much, I guess she is, but she's very much a center-left Democrat. And she's someone who has been associated with the establishment, with Hillary Clinton, with the Obama administration, with Biden. So I think that that's sort of a challenge for Democrats, where on the one hand, they are trying to lift up these more diverse voices, but I think that doesn't necessarily mean that they are meeting the demands of progressives when it comes to policy.
Caitlin, what's your take on this? What does Tanden's nomination mean for the direction of the Democratic Party?
Ultimately, I guess I'm going to take a holistic look at this. I don't think it actually matters that much in the end. I think that she certainly is a historic nomination and would make history if confirmed, but I don't think necessarily that the actual operation of the government or the Biden administration will change much if she is not confirmed. Maybe that's a little bit controversial to say, I don't know, but you know, there's no shortage of very qualified people who can do that job specifically, including Neera Tanden, to be honest with you, despite the fact that I'm generally not a fan of her public persona. I do think she's a very capable administrator. But for the sort of Democratic Party itself, I think going into the confirmation fights, I was expecting them to lose at least one or two fights anyway. It was just a matter of who it was that they wouldn't get through. So I think reality versus expectations is lining up pretty closely at this point.
Well, I feel like I know this story so much better. Thank you so much to both of you for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
That is it for this week. Our guests were Caitlin Burns, a freelance journalist and contributing writer to Vox and Medium, and Sabrina Siddiqui with The Wall Street Journal. I'm your host, El Amin Abdul Mahmoud, and I will talk to you on Thursday on the regular version of Party Lines with Rosemary Bart. I will see you then.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.